Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone.
Hello.
It's great to have all of you here
I blame it on
for this evening's event.
I blame it all.
On the last day of term.
I know that you love it.
With a long Easter weekend ahead, I'm delighted to see such a turnout. So my name is Peter Trubowitz. I'm a professor in international relations here and the director of the Fallon United States Center at LSE, which is hosting tonight's discussion about the American era. So tonight's roundtable is the sixth public event in our year-long lecture series, America's Changing Role in the World. The series is premised on the idea that America is in the throes of redefining its international purposes and priorities that arguably began before Donald Trump's presidency, but has accelerated on his watch, often, as the current war in Iran suggests, in unpredictable ways. So tonight we're going to do something a little bit different. In thinking about America's unsettled moment, we want to take a look back at how we got here, as well as speculating about what direction the country might be headed on the eve of its semi-quincentennial. This is the topic of a newly released edited volume called Rethinking the 1990s that the U.S. Center, in collaboration with the Reimagining World Order Project at Princeton University that John Eikenberry heads up, put together. We convened a group of leading scholars to reflect on the 90s and its implications for the present. And a couple of the authors are here with us tonight. Finally, tonight's event marks something of a milestone for the center at the LSE. It's our 10th anniversary. We launched back in 2015, just around the time that you know who was coming down the escalator, to announce that he was running for the presidency, and it's been like drinking from a fire hose ever since. So after tonight's discussion, we're going to take a moment to celebrate the center, that it's still standing, and in fact, it's prospering. Immediately outside, and you are all cordially invited. LSE's president and vice chancellor, Larry Kramer, is in the hall tonight and will say a few words about the center and how it fits into the LSE landscape. So at the conclusion of tonight's roundtable, I hope you will stay around to share the moment with us. Okay, so let's get down to business. We've got a star-studded panel here. Joining the panel are John Eikenberry, to my left, the Albert Milbank Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University. I'm going to be very brief here because they're all very well known. Aisha Zarikol, next to him, Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge and Politics Fellow at Emmanuel College. Mick Cox down at the end, Emeritus Professor of International Relations at LSE, a founding director of LSE Ideas, and most importantly, a U.S. Center affiliate. And Stephanie Rickard, Professor of Political Science at LSE and an affiliate of the U.S. Center as well. Welcome all. It's great to have you here. So we're going to get started, maybe just a few words about the game plan for tonight. So I ask each of them to take roughly no more than 10 minutes to address or answer tonight's summative question, which is the American era over. And then we'll move to discussion. I'll then open it up to questions both in the theater and online. I know we'll have many people online with us tonight, and we will do our level best to get as many people in as possible. So, John, we're going to start with you. Mick, you put yours. Can you take that?
Great. Thank you so much. Congratulations for putting this on, and Peter, for your 10-year leadership of the center. It's great to see what you're doing here. It's been a fantastic decade, and it's an honor to be part of these proceedings. So the question I'm asking is the question of the day, and obviously the center cares a lot about this. Is the American era over? Or I would redefine the question, is the liberal era over? Are we witnessing the end of the liberal order as we've known it for 80 years? And I think most people think we are, that this is a moment of change in world history, a kind of grand shift of the tectonic plates, that we are seeing the end of one era. We don't quite know where we're going. And certainly we can make the case for that crisis of the world order can be seen coming from all directions, not least from Washington, where we have the really quite remarkable spectacle of the United States, in the hands of the United States, putting a wrecking ball to its own post-war international order. It's extraordinary. It's hard to think in historical terms of things like this happening. We know international orders rise and fall, international orders die, but usually death comes from murder, not suicide. And so we have a spectacle of the U.S., the key architect of this post-war order, doing the deed in many ways. And so there's wide agreement, I think, for that and other reasons, that the U.S.-led liberal order is ending and it's not coming back. The next world order will be more less open, less rules-based, less Western, less liberal, less U.S.-centered. Glimmerings of what comes next are being debated everywhere. Regional blocs, predatory hegemons, spheres of influence, high-tech oligarchs, networks globally, or simply permanent crisis, a kind of just less order. So I want to disagree with these expectations and argue that the time will come after Trump, hopefully soon after Trump, when liberals and liberal internationalists will want to and find an opportunity to reimagine liberal order, to remake and the case for liberalism and liberal internationalism, an open, loosely rule-based, progressively oriented international order. That is to say, liberal states, including a post-Trump America, will want to reinvent and rebuild something that looks like liberal international order. So my thesis would be, the U.S.-led hegemonic order is breaking down, but deeper forces of liberal modernity are not dead, and future moments will exist to fight back. Or to put my thesis another way, Mark Carney at Davos, in what is the most famous speech about international order of the last cycle, said, quote, "We know the old order is not coming back. We shouldn't mourn it." My thesis is, actually, the old order may come back, and we should celebrate it. So I'm going to be the anti-Carney for tonight's performance. The Eikenberry rule is that the worse things get, the further back into history you have to go to see the upward arc of progress in the human condition. And we have to go back further each day as we watch the destruction in the world today. But broadly speaking, I think Enlightenment values harnessed to states interested in living in a hospitable world with rules and opportunities for cooperation is not a dead project by any means, even in the United States. So when I think about the future, I think about what are the premises of the liberal international project writ large, not just the American-led order, but more generally. I think there are four convictions that frame the liberal era. One is that open trade, properly managed, is better than the alternatives. Properly managed, that is to say, we still live in a world of Adam Smith and David Ricardo, although Hamilton is in the house, but Smith and Ricardo have a better room in the house and they drink better wine. So I do think that the premise that open trade generates more wealth and prosperity properly managed and distributed than blocks and mercantilist zones that seem to be emerging. Secondly, rules and institutions facilitate cooperation. They provide channels of communication, platforms for common problem solving. They reinforce through rule-based relations a certain kind of legitimacy to the order. Thirdly, democracies still have, beleaguered though they are, a cooperation advantage working together that no other grouping of states in the international order can match. So one thing I want to put in your head is the idea of groupings of states going forward. What groupings of states are most dynamic if they could be brought together as groups? What's the latent capabilities for generating power, wealth, ideas, cooperation? And I'll assert the premise that that idea still exists, that democracies have that advantage. And then fourthly, most importantly for the liberal imagination, under conditions of rising interdependence, economic, security, environmental, or so forth, the greater that rise in interdependence, the cost of lost autonomy making binding agreements, multilateral agreements, is less than the gains you get from coordinating your policies. That there is a dividend for cooperation and a growing dividend under conditions of rising interdependence. I think those four premises are very much alive and well. And if they are, then I think there's going to be room in the next world order for some kind of reform or rebuilding of the old world order. Bad things are coming down the road, and it's in our interest to hold on to that which we still have and try to rebuild it along the terms that we've known in the past, because it is an order that did exist. It's a real order as opposed to all the imagined orders that we are putting alongside it in comparison. So there is an argument. There are vested interests, constituencies, an historical record, and what I want to suggest now, a narrative of success. Now, we're talking about the 90s and the past, looking into the future. The liberal order has sustained many different body blows. I would say three that have occurred after the end of the Cold War. The Iraq War delegitimated center-right internationalists in the United States. The 2008 financial crisis delegitimated center-left internationalists, the neo-liberal turn, if you will. And then the liberal bet that China could be invited into this order and it would become a stakeholder and it would become, in one way or another, a kind of friendly state in a liberal democratic world. There are even deeper sources, and I'm sure we'll talk about this tonight, but I do want to assert that while those injuries to the liberal body politic are real, some more imagined than real, but serious, the larger story is of a century-old building process of a political formation that has emerged and grown and is more than simply about the United States or about an American president, his or her whims, if you will. Over the course of the last 80 years, there has been a kind of revolution in world politics, generated by ideas and power mustered within the liberal democratic world among the great powers that are democratic, building a kind of world system for states seeking mutual advancement. There are a lot of things that have been done under the rubric of this order. Think about it over the last 80 years. Reopening the world economy after the Great Depression and ushering in the great period of golden economic growth. Germany and Japan reorienting themselves as liberal democracies and joining this order. Germany and France launching the European Union. All these countries creating new multilateral institutions. The trilateral countries finding new ways to organize common sources of problem solving and creating a home for countries, think of South Korea and others that have come along for the ride. So to put it all in a nutshell, when we think about future world orders, what kind of groupings are most viable and most attractive to those around the world, think about what we've lived through. over the last decades and half century. Ideas and projects of the old international order remain viable and robust. Constituencies and interests still exist for some kind of reconstructed liberal order. The order has a constitutional logic. There are bargains and institutions that are available for next generation leaders to renegotiate what the terms of our interdependence are among countries that, in a deep sense, share values and interests. Ultimately, the Trump alternative is going to fail. It's failing now, and it's failing spectacularly. And that opens up what I would call a backlash to the backlash, creating an opening for not just new ideas, but refreshed old ideas. So when we ask about orders out there, mercantilist, pan-regional blocks, predatory zones, ask yourself, do large swaths of humanity want to live in those kind of orders? Is the global South going to be better in a world organized around these fractured zones of micro-imperial oppression, or some kind of renovated international order? The theory of the case, think of the four premises I suggested, are still there, and it seems to me when we engage in a competition for which group of states have viable ideas to command the future, there still is a high ground for liberals and liberal internationalists to make their case and use their agency and their narratives of success to shape the world going forward.
Thank you, John. John has made a very passionate case for the liberal order, Aisha. Mm-hmm. Something tells me we're not buying.
Actually,
you'd like to.
John and I were on a different panel on Tuesday, and I think there are more points of agreement than people would assume. Okay, so I think we need to separate the question of the American era from the liberal international order. I mean, for as long as I've been around, we kind of assumed the two things were one and the same. The American order is the same thing as the liberal international order, same thing as the Western order. And I think right now we are at a juncture where those words that we thought went together no longer go together. So the question, I think, of the liberal international order and its desirability is separate from the question of whether the American era is over and the desirability of American hegemony. So I think the liberal international order is over in the ways that matter. I mean, we teach students, you know, that liberal international order has or had, you know, three pillars. You know, the political ideational one having to do with liberalism and, you know, democracy and the political package, the institutional legal one, and then the economic free markets, free trade, that sort of stuff. I mean, simplifying a bit. I think that first pillar has taken a fatal hit. I mean, partly because of Trump, but in general, I think people have just lost belief in liberalism, you know, all over the world. People other than John, but
it's a lonely world.
Below the bus.
But I mean, also, I mean, I sympathize with John when he defends liberalism as a political ideal. I mean, nobody really defends liberalism. Like liberal parties in Europe or in the U.S., it's always like you should vote for us because the alternative is worse. Nobody's making a positive case. So, you know, and all the other political stuff that's happening, I think that part is gone. It has to be reconstituted. I think maybe it can be reconstituted, but it's taken a fatal hit. The institutional legal side, I think the international law part has also taken pretty much a fatal hit. Institutions are still around, but they are, you know, I think being, you know, toyed with to the point of breakage, you know, one day NATO, the other day, you know. The financial economic side is probably the part that's of these three pillars is the least damaged. So if you talk to colleagues or in IPE, you know, until recently at least, they were saying the 70s, 1970s was a much worse crisis point. And, you know, we survived that, so like, why, you know, it's not so bad now. But with the tariffs and Iran and, you know, what's happening, the energy crisis, I think we could also, in the financial economic realm, we could also hit something like the 70s, if not worse. So I think the liberal international order is pretty much over. I mean, I've come to the point in my classes, I don't want to, actually, I used to teach a module on the crisis of the liberal international order. Now I think, you know, it's this no longer applies. It's the end of the liberal international order. Some of these institutions will be repurposed, like, you know, peasants in Anatolia, you know, build houses with ruins from Rome. I mean, it doesn't mean that the, you know, the order will necessarily continue. So we shouldn't be just fooled by the names of the of things remaining the same or some of the infrastructure remaining the same. If it's normative content and ideals have fundamentally shifted, and I think sometimes that is missed. So that's what I would say about the liberal international order. Now, can American hegemony continue without the liberal international order? The people in the Trump administration clearly think that it can. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be doing what they're doing. I mean, some of what they're doing is nonsensical, but to the extent that, you know, there is, I mean, there are people in the administration who've thought about it, and they see the way to continue American hegemony actually by, you know, kind of dismantling the liberal international order and going into a more well, I guess what some would say like realist kind of conception of, but I'm not even sure it's realist, but some kind of power politics, let's say. So it, I think from that could come, you know, some force, power play. I'm not disputing the possibility. I don't know what Mick will say. I think he's going to make the case for that.
I'm not sure what I'm going to say. I've changed my mind already since John spoke.
What I can say is, you know, I do, you know, long duration history, and orders that are built on coercion alone tend to be quite brittle. And this is not just a modern thing. This is a generally true thing. I mean, even the Mongols allowed, like, they facilitated free trade. You know, they were quite hands off. You know, once they created their order. So I'm not sure that this. I mean, if the plan is to, you know, threaten people, you know, kind of acting like, you know, a bandit. You know, like, give me my bribe. You know, send me your soldiers and so on. I mean, that could go somewhere. But it's hard to see some kind of global order coming out of such a posture. I mean, maybe temporarily it can. I mean, certainly technologically, things are possible that weren't possible in the distant past. But I just don't see order being reconstituted through force alone. You always need ideas. And some degree of legitimacy, and some degree of buy-in. And that's where, you know, I sympathize with, you know, John's project, because, you know, whatever its flaws, the liberal international order, the liberal project did have considerable buy-in. Of course, I mean, I've criticized it for like hypocrisy and, you know, not living up to its promises and so on. But there were people all around the world who, you know, embraced the principles, still do, and their numbers may increase if, like, the choices between, you know, the Trumpian you know, force, I don't know, unpredictable display of force, or worse, I have a project on disorder. I think that's more likely, some kind of global fragmentation and disorder is more likely than some American hegemony coming back with force. If those are the choices, I think people may be attracted to what they had in the past with all its flaws. And some of these principles could, you know, find defenders again. But they will have to be rethought for a new world. You know, it cannot be the Western-centric liberal international order. I'm running out of time, so I won't get into that. The question is, who will be the architects of that new order? I mean, that's always, you know, my response to John. Even if we all agree with the plan you're presenting, John, who's going to do it? That's what I want to know. But anyway, I'll stop there. Thanks. Yeah.
Thank you, Aisha. I want to come back to that last question about who might step in. But before we do, to create a new order, Mick, you've written a lot about American declinism. It's like a theme that goes all the way back to Brooke Adams' book in 1895 on the laws of civilization and decline. He did write a book 5 years later called American Economic Supremacy, so he changed his mind.
No, never.
Is this just another bout of declinism that this too will pass?
Well, you're taking all my best lines there, Peter, thanks.
Sorry.
It's okay, and how dare you suggest that I change my mind? But John Maynard Keynes could, so I can too, okay? Well, first of all, congratulations to Peter and what you've done with the US Center. And also to a vote of thanks to Donald Trump, because he has made the United States so interesting. I mean, I like Joe Biden, preferred him, absolutely. But Trump has actually accelerated interest in the United States in ways that I could never have predicted. I even said during the first term that if you did a poster, Peter, and you stuck, I don't know, Obama in it, you get 50 people in the audience extra. If you put Trump on the poster, you get another 200. But it I don't know quite what it is, but Trump has accelerated a genuine debate and argument about the United States and where it's going. And as you suggest, Peter, so I'm only thanking him in the kind of British ironic sense. So please note that. But nonetheless, it is extraordinary. I've never heard the Today program over the last 4 or 5 weeks, which I listened to in the morning. If it doesn't start with Trump, I think something's wrong. You know, so it's extraordinary. And obviously in the United States even more, but not just, but also right around the world. I mean, on most of the issues we are talking about at the moment, the Americans dominate the debate, almost monopolize the debate. So we'll come back to that in a moment. Now, end of the American era. Well, I kind of agree and disagree with John. I think the American era is not over. Okay, I'll start with that as a kind of fundamental premise, by which I mean American power. That may not be exactly the same as era. I get that point. But I just don't think America, you talked about declinism. I've been kind of quite a strong anti-declinist for quite a long time. And I have no intention in front of all these very interesting people to change my mind, at least in public. I think there's still something fundamentally exceptional about the nature of American power. And therefore, from that point of view, the American era is not over. Whoever is sitting in the White House, it seems to me, is simply this reservoir of power. Even what we're seeing in this war over Iran, it's a demonstration of power. And everybody always orients or is sucked into the most powerful. And we're all sucked in to this debate, whether it's over Iran, whether it's over the transatlantic relationship, whether it's over trade, whether it's over Canada. I mean, you know, sorry about that. I kind of pronounce Canada a little bit negatively. I'm sorry about that for any Canadians in you. But on all these issues, the United States shapes the debate. On all these issues, it shapes the debate, which would suggest to me that if the American era is over, nobody told the Americans. And they certainly didn't tell Trump. Where I kind of, I'm completely on John's side. I mean, I can't think of an alternative order to the liberal order delivering what the liberal order has delivered. I get that, you know, freedom, free trade, all these kind of things, the kind of Keynesian stuff as well, which goes very much with it as well. And I'm a kind of great admirer of good old John Maynard Keynes. So I'm bound to say that there's much in that liberal order which is worth preserving and should be preserved. I'm a little bit more skeptical as to whether it can be, John. It's a skepticism, not a direct refutation. So we may be in a paradoxical situation of having the United States still as the dominant player in the world, but not promoting a liberal order. And that seems to me the heart of the problem. That seems to me the heart of the problem. And that, in some sense, is an expression of what we call Trumpism as well. Now, end is, I've actually read the title of what we're supposed to talk about today, and I picked up on the word end. Now, maybe because I was 79 a couple of weeks ago, I don't know. But end. I thought about this. And John, Peter, one of them, you asked, let's go back and think about it. Mm-hmm. And I've been around long enough to know that every year since 1968, people have been talking about the end of the American empire. It was Vietnam, you remember? And then we're coming off the Bretton Woods system in 70-71. Then there's the oil shocks in after 72. And I remember a lot of books I read, not by you, thank you about that, I'll let you off there, which kind of talked that we're living in a post-hegemonic era. And that was in the 70s. And indeed, dear old Ronnie Reagan, who now looks like a genius compared to what we've got at the White House at the moment, I never thought so at the time, but nonetheless, Ronald Reagan even said America's in decline. And indeed, he used declinism as a kind of a narrative in order, one of the reasons he got back into the White House. He pointed to dear Jimmy Carter and said, look at this is decline. Same way, by the way, that Trump constantly points to Joe Biden, the use of the imagery of Carter as much as the imagery of Biden. Then in the 1980s, we had another bout of declinism, endism, I should preferably call it, exemplified by the very great English historian who comes from Newcastle, called Paul Kennedy. Now, some of you may or may not remember Paul Kennedy, but he wrote a somewhat influential book. It sold 2.5 million copies, after all. 600,000 in Japanese, he told me. And in that particular book, The Rise and Fall of All Great Powers, he was told by his publishers, you've got to have something about the United States. He said, righto, so off we went. This is not a true story, but it's kind of a nice story. But it's more or less...
Too good not to tell.
No, it's too good not to tell. Too good not to tell. And in essence, what made that book the extraordinary success it was, is the biggest selling academic book in history. Okay. What made it was the chapter on the United States. In other words, what he said, that all great powers, it's a kind of realist argument, of course, which we all know about. All great powers follow the same pattern. And it was a hugely influential book. And of course, it generated its own counter-reaction, people like Haas and others, of course. And Joe Nye, too. His whole argument about soft power came up in the debate against decline. Then we had a brief interregnum we call the 1990s. Was it brief? I don't know. And the unipolar. But now we're back from 2001 onwards, back into endism. The first 10 years, by the way, Peter, you said, let's start, where does it come from? Maybe from the 1990s. But if you take the period from 9/11 through to the 2008 financial crisis, which was mentioned briefly here, that looked like the decade from hell. Looking back now, in fact, Time magazine wrote a rather good piece called The Decade from Hell, the noughties, The Decade from Hell, bookended at one end by 9/11, the Iraq War, and concluding with Iran. And then we then get the second decade from hell, and let's just call it Donald Trump. Okay. So we've had endism before, and I get the point. And it kind of leaves me skeptical, that's all. There's a beep goes off in my brain, saying, hold on, we've been here before, but nonetheless, the United States still comes back. You know, it loses the war in Vietnam. What do we get at the end of that? We got Ronald Reagan, you know. The Iraq War was a strategic disaster. This current one could be even worse, by the way. But it was a strategic disaster of the very first order. And, okay, it has consequences, but nonetheless, does it erode the foundations of American power? I'm not sure it really does. Even the 2008 financial crisis, about which so much has been written. I mean, nonetheless, the United States took taking very dramatic measures, particularly under Obama, comes out of it. And still, if we look at the basic metrics of power, John, you know this as well as I do, we still look down those metrics, and they're still very, very, very impressive. You know, you look at the GDP, boring stuff, depends which GDP measure you want, but there it is. Our old friend Bill Walthall from Dartmouth has written about this, we well know. American military power. Okay, you can fight America military power by other means, but still, it spends as much on the military as the next eight countries together. You go down other aspects of American military power. Why are the Europeans so worried about the end of NATO? Because American power will no longer be guaranteeing European security, proving, it seems to me, that there is clearly a deep worry within amongst all Europeans about America no longer using its power. But it's still got it, and that's the point I really... And that, in a sense, could be the heart of the problem we're facing, John. You know, America still retains huge power to do damage, which it's doing now, in my opinion, and I'm not saying anything terribly original, but has huge power to do good. But it's still got that power. And that's really where I kind of end my conclusion. The only other thing I just end on very quickly and try and stay within the limits... How America is simply defying so many of the agendas today. I mean, I try to make a list. Trade, tariffs equals the United States. Transatlantic relationship, what are we talking about? Trump, America. Ukraine war, what is that dependent upon? The United States, let's be perfectly honest. The Europeans are doing a pretty good job, I think, but they're doing it without the American support. That therefore means that Ukraine could go under. Let's be perfectly honest and bleak about it. I don't want it to happen. The Middle East, what we're seeing today. America. Canada. I mentioned Canada early on. Trump changed Canadian politics by claiming that he wanted to make Canada, you know, the 51st state. That's power in a negative sense, in a very negative sense. Greenland. Who ever talked about Greenland before except Danes and Greenlanders? Suddenly we're all talking about the end of NATO because of Greenland. Why? Because the United States has defined it as being an issue. And dare I say, finally, I must mention, of course, the UK. Poor old Starmer. Come on, guys. You've got to feel sorry for Keir. There he is. He couldn't have done more appeasing if he'd tried. Yeah. He kept appeasing Donald, and Donald wouldn't listen to him. But again, it's defining British politics. It's redefining the nature of British politics. It's going to redefine, actually, British attitude even towards the European Union. That would not have happened without the United States and without Trump. And on that note of either optimism or pessimism, I shall conclude, Peter. Thank you very much.
Very good, Mick. Thank you. So, Stephanie, you're an expert on international trade.
Yeah, you too.
Mick has just laid down some markers about... Yeah. Trump and trade, certainly Trump's kept you very, very busy. His main complaint, I think, and not just his, I mean, you'd hear this from Besant and Greer and others, is that the American liberal order, the kind of trade liberalization in particular, no longer works for the United States. That it is a threat. It's eroded American manufacturing. It has eroded the economic security that Americans have enjoyed.
I can't hear you.
That it has eroded the economic security that Americans have enjoyed. I mean, how do we get to this point? Can you kind of like take us back a little bit and provide some perspective on it?
Thanks, Peter. It's always hard to speak after Mick because he's so engaging, but I'll give it a go. So, look, you know, we have to go back. Yeah. And I think my thesis, if I'm taking a page out of John's book and having a thesis, would be that this is not, the backlash that we observe is not about multilateralism. Mm. It's not discontent with the WTO. It's actually the consequences of this dramatic increase that we've seen in international trade. That dramatic increase that we've seen in international trade has serious economic consequences, serious political consequences, and none of that has been coupled with sufficient programs to offset the losses, to retrain the workers that have been displaced, and to get them back into the labor market. So there is discontent, there is a backlash against globalization and the WTO, the World Trade Organization, but it's, I would argue, not really about multilateralism. And so if we go back to the 1990s, trade has increased enormously. Since 1995, when the World Trade Organization was established, trade volume has increased by 400%. This has completely changed the structure of the global economy, countries' relations with one another, and how firms do business. They can now have very complex global supply chains across multiple national barriers. And so this has really changed the global economy, and that's had intense economic consequences, which I want to go to first. It's also had intense political consequences, which I'll go to second. And then third, I'll come back to Peter's question about the role of multilateral institutions. But first, starting with the economic consequences. We've seen, as the same time that trade has increased dramatically, a huge reduction in global poverty, a big increase in aggregate welfare and economic growth. But we know that the picture is not all rosy. We know that trade has distributive consequences within countries. And that's true for rich, poor, developed, developing, north, south. Within every country, some groups will win from increased trade, but other groups will lose. And we've seen people lose their jobs, we've seen wages decrease, and we've seen incomes decrease. In the United States, for example, we've seen the furniture manufacturing industry really decline because of rising imports from China. More generally, we know that increased imports from China account for 25% of the manufacturing job losses that the United States has experienced since the beginning of the 2000s. So these are individual consequences, right? People are losing their jobs. But these are also consequences for communities, for local labor markets, and for regions. So we know that these job losses are often geographically concentrated. So that furniture manufacturing community in the United States was really concentrated in the South, and particularly in the state of Kentucky. And so when this industry started to experience competition from lower cost foreign imports, we see them closing factories and laying off workers. And when that was the local industry, that means entire communities were decimated. Not only people individually losing their jobs, but other industries as well. People working in the local supermarket, the local schools, all affected by trade.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
And so the fact that these economic consequences are geographically concentrated have really important political consequences. And we can see that not only in voting behavior, but also in the values that people are adopting. Mm-hmm. So in France, for example, we see that these areas that are most exposed to rising imports are precisely where voters are turning to the far-right party. Mm-hmm. It's in these areas that have been hit by rising foreign imports that the far right is gaining traction and gaining leverage. In the United Kingdom, we see areas that were most exposed to rising imports are where we see the highest support for Brexit, but it's also where we see people adopting more authoritarian values. These are values for order, conformity, and the implementation of these values even by the use of force. So this value adoption or this value of change is happening precisely in these areas where they're most exposed to rising foreign imports. So this exposure to trade, it's changing politics, it's also changing values, it's driving people to extreme parties, it's driving people to populism. And so is there a role for the multilateral institutions in this? I would suggest the multilateral institutions are less important for these political chains than the policy themselves and the distributive consequences of these policies. So in my own research, for example, I've tried to test exactly this question. And what I found is that people react negatively to distributive policies that generate losses. But when I tell them that there is an international institution involved, that doesn't shift the dial. That doesn't make them dislike the policy anymore. So it doesn't look like this discontent is really situated in the multilateral institutions or in the liberal order. It's really situated in the policy changes, the rise in trade that subsequently followed, and the distributive consequences that are being felt by people in these countries. So to me, that suggests two ways forward. First, continue to invest in multilateral institutions. These are not necessarily the problem. I'm not saying the World Trade Organization is perfect. Of course, there are problems. It needs to be updated. We need to get bigger buy-in. We need to progress many of the reform agenda issues that were spoken about last week at the ministerial conference in Cameroon. But continuing to invest in these multilateral institutions is part of the solution. The World Trade Organization is a really important part of the global economy. If it collapsed tomorrow, the world economy would shrink by 5%. To put that in context, COVID reduced the global economy temporarily by 3%. So this would have a big consequence for the global economy and for global growth. And so this is an institution that is still functioning. 70% of global trade is still being conducted under WTO rules. It doesn't mean there's not room for reform. There is, but I would say continue to invest in multilateral institutions. Second, continue to invest and build and strengthen the safety nets. We need programs to help offset the costs that have been engendered by globalization. So that means building and funding programs that help workers be retrained, be reskilled, become reemployed. We have some programs like this. In the European Union, for example, has a European Globalization Adjustment Fund. I've tried to study the effects of this program, and it looks like it does work. It gets people back in jobs, it gets people retrained, and when they receive this support, it reduces the probability of voting for the far-right party. So more support to retrain workers can turn the political tide around. Even more generally, though, for bigger impacts, for bigger, longer-term impacts, we arguably need more policies, more programs, broader programs that can help build a lifelong ladder of opportunity, that can help build human capital so that everyone can react and respond to these labor market shocks, whether they're from globalization or from AI or from the green energy transition. I'll leave it there.
That's great, Stephanie. So thank all of you. Those are terrific opening comments. We have a few minutes maybe for a conversation up here before I open things up. I want to pick up on a couple of points that that have been raised here. One that I think, Aisha, at the end of your presentation, you said, well, you know, the question is, what did I have here? Who's going to be the architects, the actors, and so forth? And this takes me back to Mark Carney's speech at Davos, because I think Carney said two things there. One is he kind of pulled the Band-Aid off on the liberal order. So he said out loud what all the leaders thought, you know. So, and he may be selling the U.S. short and so forth. But the second thing he said there was that he encouraged, and I think this has gotten traction in this country, and it matters since it's going to be hosting the G20 and the G7. Is that middle powers should unite. Get up, stand up, you know, kind of, okay, didn't quote Bob Marley, but you know, to counter not only the United States, but other predatory powers that are out there. So I guess the question is, this is an alternative, you know, it's got fancy names, variable, geometry, diplomacy, coalitions of the willing is really what it boils down to. I mean, is this like a plausible idea in a world where there are great powers? You know, I mean, is he barking or is it just a pipe dream? So it'd be really great. John, why don't you go?
Yeah, I think that is a great question, and it's relevant to the larger question. Who are going to be the architects of the next world order? And if it's liberal, who are the liberal architects? And that's your question. I like to think of that question as, who will be the next Sumner Wells, who was the great theorist that FDR and that generation looked to imagine not just global multilateralism, but hemispheric and regional Atlantic multilateralism. So who is that going to be? My non-Carney proposal is that the trilateral world, Western Europe, North America, Japan and Korea, and some other states along the way, is a formation that has a lot of history, institutional structures. That we'll call it the trilateral world, the G7, we can make it the D10 world, that is the rebuilding coalition post-Trump. And it should be, going back to basics, a trade security coalition. What made this order, it was not a global liberal order, it was a group of states, relatively small, but shared, they were advanced industrial democracies with common problems. The 30s and 40s had thrown them out of whack, and they needed to be put back on a common footing. They shared problems, deep problems that historical sociologists tell us about, the problems of advanced industrial societies, all the different compromises and institutions that you need. And so they share a common predicament. And that is the grouping, not a ad hoc middle power coalition, which unfortunately draws you into partners with what, Saudi Arabia? You know, or Turkey. I mean, it's not, Carney went to China after he made his big speech. Yeah, yeah. Good luck there.
Yeah.
That doesn't sound like that Carney is the champion of elevated values. But, so there is a different, there's a different coalition, I think. And I think starting small, beleaguered, partly, fully maybe, dysfunctional democracies, knowing that they have to reimagine their space, but there is a latent underlying dynamic, a Walforth, there are scholars who have given us that sense of why collaboration among this set of countries that have this grouping is the most efficacious of any grouping you can imagine. So okay. that's the key in my view.
Okay, I'm tempted, I'm the chair though, to jump in, but Mick put a two finger up before, so
Mick, got in quick. Yeah, well, the answer to the question, who's the next leader, John? Well, I think it's China, isn't it? I mean, am I being naive? I mean, you know, I mean, everything that we've said why China couldn't rise, it's contradicted. I was saying 10 years ago, and I know much less about China than a number of other people in this audience, but I was saying 10-15 years ago, and wasn't even on the basis of being in China, I didn't think China could make the great leap into the next technological revolution, and guess what it has done? Precisely that. I know a number of entrepreneurs, business people in the whole of Europe who are absolutely sweating about Chinese exports. So if there is a next leader, John, I don't think we need to look to a coalition. I think the next leader is already there. It's out there. It's doing the business in Africa, Latin America. I'm not overdoing it, but it's there. And that also raises the question for me, John, very briefly, as to what, you know, the problem of a liberal order. You know, if it's being defined by China, although they buy into, you know, all sorts of other things, like, you know, they love globalization, at least on their own terms and all the rest of it. Nonetheless, if that is the next challenger, which clearly is already in economic terms, nobody else is anywhere near China. Miles behind, the other BRICS are all miles behind, then it's got to be China. And if it is China, John, which I suspect that it is, and I don't think I'm coming up with any great empirical observations on that, then that does raise real questions about the future of that liberal order, which I agree with you, I prefer, but I'm not too sure with China leading it, it's going to be too liberal in the sense that you mean it.
Seems like it would also raise questions about whether you get public goods in the same way. Stephanie.
Yeah. We don't have to think about this hypothetically. We've already seen middle powers shape the multilateral institutions. So since the WTO was formed in 1995, they've agreed to multilateral agreements. One of them was just quite recent, and the largest contributor of text to that agreement was a coalition of five middle powers who had shared interest. So it wasn't the G77, it wasn't a huge grouping. Five middle powers, all global South powers, and they contributed the largest share of text to only the second ever multilateral agreement at the World Trade Organization. So I think that shows that middle powers can lead, they are leading, they're shaping the new trading rules already.
Aisha, you raised the question.
I mean, I think the middle powers that Stephanie was talking about are different than the middle powers that John was talking about. I think John was suggesting kind of a coalition of democratic middle powers, Canada, Europe, Australia, maybe Korea and Japan and so on. I don't doubt that middle powers, I don't even know what middle powers anyway, but, you know, countries that call themselves middle powers.
Canada.
they can...
The UK.
UK. UK,
yeah.
I mean, who's not a middle power these days?
Yeah. We're all middle powers now.
These countries can come together to create trade agreements and, you know, multilateral arrangements. Every middle power is hosting some kind of informal diplomatic summit these days. So they can take over those parts. But I don't know that means that we get the liberal international order back. Mm-hmm. I mean, that sort of stuff has existed. I mean, I keep harping on history, but it's not like specific to you know. I mean, we have a more sophisticated forms of it. But people talking to each other and people trading, you know, like that's not like exactly a new invention. So I think the problem is, if the liberal international order is going to come back, who's going to do it? That was my question. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, Europe has its own illiberal, nativist, all sorts of elements who are, you know, now a little bit down because of Trump, association with Trump. But the Russia stuff keeps, you know, inflaming that. Especially in East and Central Europe. So are they going to be the champions of liberalism going forward? I'm not so sure. I mean, you said they would have to go to Turkey. I don't say this as like, you know, Turkey, but Europe has been going to Turkey all the time. Like in the last month, they've signed like 10 different agreements because they think that they can't do now in this brave new world without Turkey. And so it's, in theory, it sounds great. In practice, I don't know what it looks like.
Okay, we're going to open it up. I realize we're a little past 7:30, so I'm going to take questions. I'll take a group of questions, a couple from in the theater, and then one online. For those of you online, you just should be using the Q&A function. Make sure you provide your name and affiliation. And for those of you in the theater, raise your hand and do please introduce yourselves. So, hands, lots of hands. So, how about that person in the way back?
That hand.
Right there. You've got it. You have one finger up. That's it.
Hello. All right. We've got the one microphone. That helps.
Yeah.
Hello. Thank you very much for a very insightful discussion today. It was a pleasure hearing everybody. My question is specifically to Mike. When you mentioned that China is standing there as in response to ISIS question as to who's going to take over, so is it really going to be the way that we see in the American era, so to speak, looking at the topic for discussion today? And what is it going to look like? What if China actually joins hands with Russia? They have a relationship, albeit not a very touted one, but still it exists. So what's the world going to look like after that?
Okay.
So there was a hand right here in the center, right, in a white shirt, or I don't know.
You could stand up when I speak.
Yeah. Yeah, good idea to stand up if you can, so you can hear better. Yeah.
Hello, my name's Els Taylor. I'm with the European Institute here at the LSE. Thank you for coming. So I'm curious, like, the Liberal National Order used to be a regional order. It started mostly in the Atlantic with the Atlantic political community. And then come the Cold War, it became, to simplify things, one of two orders. And then after the Soviet Union dissolved, just the international order as we know it today. Do we expect to see like another competing order with like China or Russia? Or could we just expect radical transformation of the current order?
Okay, that's a great question. Chris? Right up here in the front. You're just waiting for it. Okay. Chris, right behind you.
Thank you. Just to say that there are more than 200 people watching tonight online from countries including India, Brazil, Ireland, Poland, Spain, Pakistan, South Korea, Germany, Turkey, Canada, the US, and the UK. This question comes from Jay Young, who is an LSE alumnus from South Korea. The United Nations arguably has been functioning as the most important institution for safeguarding the world order and promoting world peace. Meanwhile, it also constantly faces calls for reform. What role should the UN play in our times, and if reform is needed, what form should it take? Thank you.
That's great. Okay, we got China, an alternative order, the club order, two club orders, and the UN.
Why are you looking at me? Okay.
China.
I'll tell you.
And let's have clipped answers. And
On the liberal international order, I think what was implicit in that, did it ever really exist in the Cold War? Can we talk of a liberal international order during the Cold War? I mean, in some ways you can. You could say the Cold War made the liberal international order, by definition, I think it did, Marshall Plan, transatlantic relationship. On the other hand, did you not notice there was quite a lot of illiberal powers throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s? They were called the Soviet Union, and as we used to call it once upon a time, Communist China. So, as I think John Mearsheimer once said, the liberal international order as a geographical entity, as opposed to an idea, really, if you like, only came about, I think, in the 1990s. If you want to kind of take the notion of it spanning the whole globe, and I think that's the only point I would make on that one. On China, very quickly, I mean, there's so much you put into that question. China and Russia, actually, by the way, have a very close relationship. It's not just that they're aligned, they are very closely aligned, and they've been so since 2001. And I won't bore you to tears with the book I didn't write on this relationship. But nonetheless, this is a very deep and profound relationship. Whether you want to call it an alliance or not, I don't really care, but they're close, they're very close. And the whole of the Ukraine war, which I was told was going to explode the relationship, has done quite the opposite. And in a sense, they therefore do align. They don't have fundamentally identical interests, but they have enough common interests together. And this gets back to the liberal order, John. This is a very serious alignment of two nations which are very serious players in the international system. And again, that raises for me real problems about whether the liberal international, are liberals dealing very well with that challenge? And I'm not sure they are. In fact, if you go to, quote-unquote, the global south, a term I don't particularly like, you go to the global south, there's a kind of sense that, well, you know, Russia's not so bad, you know, you see that vote in the UN, well, they're not so bad, they invaded Ukraine, but okay, wasn't it all about NATO? You know, so in a way, an illiberal argument has found a place around the world on this, and blaming the West and double standards has also eroded some part of the legitimacy of liberal order. I mean, I don't think it's all fair, but that's the way it is. On the UN, I've got nothing to say except we've been talking about the reform of the UN since it was established back in 1945, and it hasn't really happened. But the UN, and this is why I say, it's not the General Assembly, it's not the PFI, it's what the UN does through its various agencies, which is so critical. And we need to talk much more about that too, but we haven't done that this evening, so I apologize.
Stephanie.
No, there's no radical alternative, but that doesn't mean we're going to see business as normal. At least in trade, there's fracturing. We have China, the US, and the EU, each pushing their own idea of what the future of multilateral trade will look like going forward, but it's none of them are radical alternatives to what we have right now.
Aisha?
Are we going to see a major transformation, replacement of this order? I mean, I think the mistake is to assume that something new will emerge anytime soon. I mean, I worry that we're going to get caught in this like limbo moment for a very long time, and it's kind of going to be like the Iran war. It's over. No, it's actually escalating. No, you know, it's just we won't know what is happening, like what the order is. What the rules are, and I think that's a bigger problem than an alternative order emerging.
John?
Yeah, it's true that historically speaking, looking across centuries, order building has occurred after major wars, after big ruptures, and with nuclear weapons and what seems to be the irrationality of great power war in this age of concentrated violence. How do you get a mechanism that truly escorts the old order out and creates a new set of strong states to put forward a new set of ideas, which happened, you know, 1648, 1713, 1815, and so forth. Just another point about liberal order, since liberal international order is a term that I didn't realize this at the time, but my co-author and I were the first to use it in a scholarly article in 1999, and it didn't occur in the New York Times until 5 years later, so I'm to blame in some sense. But what we mean by liberal order is orders that have liberal characteristics, two meanings really, reciprocity, rule of law, openness, but also liberal international order, order that is created by liberal democracies to make themselves safe. And some of those features are not liberal, like alliances, which protect you as a club in a dangerous world. And so it's always a kind of subset of a larger system. It tends to sit on top of the Westphalian order, which is enshrined in the United Nations. I don't see a great competitor to it. That was part of my thesis, that other groupings with ordering projects, world order projects, think of it in those terms, great powers with modernity projects. The 20th century was full of them. Mm. Actually, liberal international order escorted them all off the stage. So this is why it's very hard for somebody who looks across the centuries to say, how can an order that 25 years ago survived all these great clashes with fascism and communism and autocratic rule and imperial projects, and now it's going to go underwater in just 25 years, having done what it's done? It doesn't seem quite right, particularly if it's being taken apart by its architects and not necessarily by a new set of states that want something different. Final point about China. I disagree with Mick in the sense that I don't see China offering or capable of ordering the world in the way the U.S. did in its period.
I agree.
And it's partly because China is deeply ambivalent. I'm looking at Rosemary here, but partly because it's ambivalent about whether it wants something new or not. In many ways, it would like the old America to return to a kind of Westphalian leadership role. But secondly, the Chinese development model is export-based, driven by high savings rates that are astronomical in comparative perspective, 40% rather than 24% for OECD and 17% for the United States. So it needs to export production to grow. So for China to have greater economic growth, they need to take jobs away from Germans who build cars. BMW will have to give way in this model, because it's, and sector after sector, China's going to come after Airbus and Boeing. So these industrial societies that have social contracts written on a middle class that can have employment, even if you didn't go to college, at a middle class level, because you are in a factory society that does things that generates manufacturing. But if the largest or next largest economy in the world is radically upsetting that equilibrium, and it can't reform itself because it doesn't have social security, it doesn't have the substitute for domestic savings because the state can't provide it, and you have one child policy, all the demographics working against reform in China, it's a disaster waiting to happen. And who are the groupings of, what is the grouping of states that are most vulnerable to that? And it is the industrial democracies. So once again, trilateralism has to return if there is going to be a future for advanced industrial democracies.
Another round of questions. I take this young gentleman up here in the front with the...
Thank you very much, Peter, and for all your excellent work at the U.S. Center. Congratulations on the 10 years. This question may be more for Stephanie, but anyone else that wants to chime in. And I want to weave in some economics. I think Mick touched on the guns and butter period, or maybe not expressly, but empires and hegemons run out of money. Okay, and Nixon blew up the Bretton Woods system when John Connolly said, it's our currency and it's your problem. So if we're looking forwards, maybe in 3 years' time, the Wizard of Oz, Donald Trump, Besson, however you want to characterize them, they do have a plan and a strategy. Whether it plays out and works is another matter. But it's the dollar. It's always about the dollar. And we live in an era of digital AI. So Besson has spoken about this, but we are going to get a US dollar stablecoin system backed by US treasuries. And ultimately, capital flows matter. So if we're back here in 3-4 years' time and we have a US-backed stablecoin treasury system, the dollar is even more powerful because it circumvents every other central bank and trading system in the world. So interested if you agree with that premise and if we are in that path, where it leads us. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard, an LSE alum. So how about this woman right here? Yeah. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk so far. My name's Olivia. I'm a current
manager.
Who are you? Stand up.
Oh.
Yes. It's easier. We can't hear you properly. Great, thanks.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. My name's Olivia. I'm a current management student here at the LSE. And my question here is, we've talked a bit about kind of groupings of states. We've talked about certain multilateral organizations and institutions such as the UN. But I was wondering, when talking about groupings of states, how kind of regional blocks then form into this. So for example, the Arab League, the African Union, ASEAN, especially when we're seeing that we're currently in this limbo moment, discussions around NATO, around the EU have also started really emerging. So I was wondering your take on the role, if there's any change in the role or what the role of such regional blocks and regional organizations play in this current era. Thank you.
Okay, great. Chris?
Thank you. This question comes from Udo Schmeiser, who asks, an international order is based on strong actors and the EU is one among others. Within the EU, Germany is something like a semi-hegemon. What role could it or should it play?
Okay. Regional blocks, Germany, the dollar. I think the dollar has you all over, Stephanie.
Okay, all right. Talk about the dollar. This is a very astute point. You're absolutely right. We cannot talk about the end of America as long as the dollar is dominant. Exactly. And it is dominant, and it will continue to be dominant. And the developments you suggest, it might become even more dominant. But that's not to say that other states aren't chasing it, right? Other states don't like being held hostage by the dollar, right? We see alternatives to the Swiss program, the SWIFT program trying to be developed. We see other central banks trying to get into the game of stablecoins. So there's efforts, right? We see the yuan, we see China trying to weaponize yuan and saying, you know, you will pay us back in our currency. So there are efforts being made, but the inroads are shallow. And so I think you're making a very astute point that this question is almost unnecessary until we see a decline in dollar dominance. Can I say something
sure.
About regional?
Yeah.
Regional agreements is a really good point, and we see big variation across the efficiency and effectiveness of regional organizations, in part because of what we talked about earlier, which is, do they really have a shared common interest? So ASEAN, much more cohesive, much more shared common interest, particularly with the neighbor to the north. The African Union, much more diverse and much less effective. And we've seen time after again, trying to get a shared currency, get trade agreements, get barriers down internally within the union, and it hasn't worked. But one thing that is interesting is this long-standing debate about, are regional agreements stumbling stones or building blocks? And they might be building blocks. So in this multilateral agreement that I was mentioning at the WTO, many of the rules were copied from CPTPP. So that's a good example of a regional block, less regional now that the UK is in, but a regional block that actually facilitated agreement and liberalization and took it to the multilateral level and got it to work at the multilateral level.
That's great. Mick, you wanted to jump in and then maybe somebody wants to pick up
on
Germany?
On the dollar, which I'm not an economist, so therefore I can talk about it. empires run out of money. Well, I don't see, if we were to call the United States an empire, I don't really care. It has all the features of an empire, but it doesn't call itself an empire. Empire in denial, if you like. But as Stephanie said, I mean, the dollar is... I mean, we thought after 2008, a lot of other currencies are going to come up to replace it. They didn't. You know, China... I mean, I've just been doing a chapter for John in the next book he's editing. He works far too hard, by the way. And it was on the BRICS, and I've kind of gone through all the stuff on the BRICS about trying to replace the dollar. And guess what? It's not got very far. It's really not got very far. It's not, and this is where China is weak, John, and I take your point on that, about it's not exactly like the United States. I was simply saying in terms of power, it's the only one I can see at the moment on the new kid on the block. There's no question, all the efforts to do so have proven to be full. Now, there's a little bit of bilateral trade going on between Russia and China. They do it bilaterally, almost like, you know, it's not really like trade at all. I'd also add to the money bit, the guns bit. You know, I mean, you still got the guns, and nobody has the guns like the United States of America. I mean, it's a fundamental aspect. All transitions, you say, John, occur after wars. But why do wars win or lose wars? Well, many reasons, but one, because your guns are better, you've got more of them, you've got more allies. And that's what also gives the United States, it seems to me, those guns still give the United States. We may kind of look at what's going on in Iran and say, what a disaster, which almost certainly will turn out to be. But it's still an extraordinary demonstration of raw military power. It's not going to transform Iran in the direction that a lot of people want it to do. I'd also add to that, the third prop of this power I was talking about isn't just the dollar, it's not just the gun, it's also the corporations. I mean, I was told many years ago that all American corporations are going to be replaced by Japan. That was the Paul Kennedy thesis, you remember, many years ago. But still, when you look at corporate power in the world today, John, this is why I think the American era is not quite over just yet. That's still pretty impressive. You know, I mean, you look at the size of NVIDIA and you look at the size of all these big AI. Where's the AI revolution happening? Well, it's happening everywhere, but who's at the epicenter of this particular AI revolution, which people keep talking about incessantly, and I understand why? Well, it looks to me like the United States, unless I'm completely wrong, and they're kind of leading the way in many ways. It doesn't mean to say China's not going to get in. So if you take those three props, the dollar, the gun, and AI, and the amount of money that the United States and corporations are putting into AI, that seems to me to not guarantee the American era, but it puts a lot of solid underpinnings under that particular American era, yeah. Going back to the thesis I was putting earlier.
John, you want to jump in?
Well, I it's sort of more reacting to Mick than...
That's fine.
You know, I agree with you about the power capabilities are still there. You know, the question that I struggle with, and I think a lot of people in this room do, is will that power be harnessed to a liberal vision of the United States' role in the world or not? And it clearly is not today. Yeah. I think it could well in the future, because the U.S. is an idea, and, sure, and Trump is in some sense the great anti-American. I mean, it really is a denial of this larger vision of the United States going all the way back to the preamble. And so, you know, one way of asking, you know, U.S. going forward, is it going to be, you know, what I think of as Trump's America, or trying to think of the alternative, Obama's America. And Obama's America is that kind of work in progress. We haven't solved all of our problems. We're trying to close the gap between principles and reality. We've done it. Think of Lincoln, think of FDR and the Long New Deal, we're kind of doing that kind of work of making our society better, multicultural. Look at me, I come from different parts of the world, different races. I am America. And in some ways, why I think Obama's America is going to beat Trump's America is that more of America is like Obama. That in some sense, Trump is a backlash to what is the more fullness of the America that's been in the making for decades and centuries. And so the horses are out of the barn. We have major American states that are a majority minority, that are based on an America that is bigger than what Trump wants to build his camp on. And so he's going to lose. But Trump is not, and we know, we can see it coming. There's always been what I would call alt-America. It's from the very beginning. You know, John Adams called it the slaveocracy, and then Jim Crow. There's always been that part of, that isn't liberal America. America is not liberal America. America is America with liberal America in it and a lot of alternatives. And we're having a fight. And I I do think history is on the side of, of the alternative to Trump. So I just, what I, I don't care so much about raw military power as how it's harnessed. And I would, you know, nobody, you know, nobody defends liberalism anymore. I'm a very lonely, it's a very lonely person. But
we love you.
But this is my last point. I wanted to get this in. What I heard tonight is, and Mick said this, you know, John, I like your idea, but, you know, I'd like to live in your world, but I don't think it's going to be there. And so that is kind of, I hear that all the time. Everybody would prefer this to blocks and imperial zones and spheres of influence and coercive orders. So I think there's a latent set of convictions that are harnessed to people living in a world looking looking into the future and saying we would like to work towards something a little bit better than what we have now, because this is pretty dangerous. So I'm hoping that there is a coalition out there.
I'm with you, John. I'm with you. You know that.
Yeah, sure.
We can go to questions.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll just ask a question here to kind of wrap it up in a way. So, I mean, there's a lot of conversation here about power and the role that America's got the dollar, America's got the guns, America's got maybe not the technological edge it had 10 years ago, but still got an edge. But as IR scholars, we've also been taught that what matters a lot is the credibility of your commitments. And it's not just the power, it's the willingness to stand by, to be reliable, to stand up for what you've actually committed to. So we're watching this week. I mean, the last 36 hours have been really, really crazy. So we're watching not only a president, but a secretary of state who just in 2023 said it's a damn good thing that Congress put into place a law that would prevent any president from pulling out of NATO. That it would only require congressional consent. But that's not what the Secretary of State is saying right now. That's not what Donald Trump is saying. He's threatening that right now. I mean, you can have power, but if you if you need a club, you need allies. You need the Japanese, you need the Australians, you need the Canadians, right? And you're raising serious doubts about those commitments. I mean, do those chickens come home to roost or not?
Okay, let me just jump in on to John and then quickly. What is going to be determined by Nietzsche and John, and I totally go along with you, it's going to be determined by the American people. That's this is going to be the ultimate arbiter of what we're talking about. It's not what's happening in the international system, although that will have an impact, we know. It's what the American people decide and what they decide about this particular president. So, and one of the fundamentals of the United States is the checks and balances are not working very well, but I don't believe even Donald Trump's going to try and get rid of, you know, voting, although he may gerrymander. Hey, Larry, you can't, you're the boss, you can't disagree with me. Or you can if you want. But I, you can do the gerrymander, but in the end, you know, the chickens will come home to roost. You know, in the end, it will be decided by the ballot box. It will be decided in votes. You know, and what we saw in New York and what we saw in, you know, some of the governor's positions, I think that does tell us a lot about the potential of that. But what it's going to depend on, John, and this is what I get back to, it's going to depend, as Mrs. Thatcher once said, about alternatives. And at the moment, the Democratic Party, and let's get back to politics here just for one second, I'm not sure the Democratic Party presents a serious alternative to what is on offer. And that's what worries me most about the liberal order, John, because it's going to depend, as we all know, you put forward a program, you put forward candidates, and you put forward a president who looks credible to more Americans, who look, that, that's what's going to determine it in the end. And it will be determined, Larry, I think, at the end at the ballot box. Whatever the fiddling going on, whatever the gerrymandering going on, in the end, I think that's where we actually are. And it's really therefore going to depend on the American people and the nature of the Democratic Party getting its act together.
Mick did a very nice job. He ran out the clock.
Never got
an answer to my question. We're in overtime right now, and I'm going to bring it to an end.
Hey,
so there's a reception outside. Please join us, and please join me in thanking our panelists for a great discussion.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.